Tell us about this remarkable labor history class that you taught in November with rank and file activists. Tell us about the genesis of the course and how you collaborated with Portland Rising of Jobs with Justice to get it going.
October and November, actually, but a limited number of classes, which is already an interesting kind of decision. Jobs with Justice, I hope our listeners know what that organization is. It's a coalition of a lot of groups in town, and it tries to emphasize the commonality of struggles and bring people out for each other's struggles, bring groups out for each other's. Within J with J, there's a committee, Portland Rising, that I think goes a little bit further in its intentions, and that's really to emphasize that each one of our struggles is all of our struggles. And so the course came about by thinking, wouldn't it be very interesting, wouldn't it be important even, wouldn't it be a contribution to bring together rank and file activists, people who spend their free time trying to build some kind of an alternative within labor, most of them thinking in terms of changing the society, you know, going much beyond simply building unions or simply building the kind of unions that we have. Wouldn't it be interesting to bring together people from different workplaces, from different unions, in a common kind of project? And so that's the genesis of the course.
So why labor history? Why did the group decide to focus on history?
There are a lot of answers to that question, but one of them is that it's always easier to deal with contemporary concerns, with our concerns, with our problems, by looking first at some other time or some other place. People get the principles and then figure out how to apply them to their own situation. I want to tell you how I began the course, even. It was not so much with history as with just looking at our surroundings, our city, how a labor historian would look at the city. So it took them on an imaginary walk through the city. We actually stayed in the same room. Some people closed their eyes, some people didn't. And we moved around this familiar city, familiar to everybody in the group. The first level was, of course, the sites of great labor events. So that there are lots, of course. Portland is rich with labor events, many of them struggles, many of them strikes. But so in our imagination, we went out to Pier Park and looked at the site of the 1934 longshore struggle, and Pier Park in particular, where there are bullet holes in the trees from the police coming through on a train, shooting up at the strikers, and the next day the strikers succeeding in stopping the train, which was bringing in scabs to try to break the strike. Or we went into Northwest Portland, again in our imagination, and looked at the site where the unions in town put out their own daily newspaper during the great Oregonian and Oregon Journal strike of 1959 to 1964. And there are many of those kinds of episodes. And then we went to another level, which was just going around the city and looking extensively at buildings and thinking to ourselves, who actually did that work? Who built them? Who works in them now? Is that work gendered? Was the building of them gendered? Etc. Trying to imagine the work and the way that work itself has changed. And that, of course, is one of the motifs of the course, is the way in which the possibilities for organizing stem from also the way in which work has changed, and even who should control the way that work changes and technological innovation.
I was going to say, just in terms of physical space too, just change over time and thinking about how the city's become more gentrified and how certain sites closer in were very much sites of working class struggle and where working people lived and how that has changed certainly in the last few decades.
And continues, right, and continues to change. And then the third level we went to, and this was unexpected by people in the class, I think, was to look back at decisions that have been made in working class communities about our surroundings. And I mean actual decisions. And so the example that I started out with was Andrew Carnegie coming to Portland around the turn of the 20th century and proposing to build Carnegie Libraries. Andrew Carnegie, of course, had been the steel magnate who broke the Homestead strike, who broke unions in steel. And here, late in life, he's feeling philanthropic. And so he comes to Portland, as he comes to every place in the country, and says, I want to build you libraries. I will pay for the libraries. The question, do we accept? And so we had a kind of simulation where we were the organized workers from that time period. We were the typographers and we were the brewers, etc. And do we accept this money? What's very interesting, and there are other decisions like that, of course, that the working class in this town has weighed in on. I'll give you another example in a minute. Some places in the country refused. They said, this is blood money. Wheeling, West Virginia, the organized labor movement there said, no, we're not going to take Carnegie's money. We have a different route. We want a library. We want it in our working class community. In fact, we're literate. We read, we workers, but we're not going to take it from Carnegie. Portland, as it turns out, has 6 libraries within its boundaries that Carnegie built. Those of you who know the library system out there, North Portland Library is a Carnegie library. Tidal Wave, where the library gets rid of its excess books, was built by Carnegie, etc. There are a few. Another example would be our park system here in Portland. These great parks that we have, the Olmsted brothers came to Portland and sold the parks that they designed for Portland based on, we need to have some way to diffuse working class militancy. And so we're going to build these parks for you. Do you accept this? And there was an opportunity for workers weighing in. And of course, the city went quite along with it. And we've got great parks that, in fact, we use as workers, not only for recreation, but we rally, of course, and there are many labor events that use them. But that's the origin of great parks we have, like Selwood Park would be an example, that was built specifically to undermine working class militancy. So that's how we began the course.
It seems to me that's a great way to think about the past and the present, to just look around at the physical spaces in which we reside. So these were working people, activists who had limited time. How did you decide on what topics to focus in the short amount of time that you had together?
Yeah, we initially set out to have only 5 classes. That's a ridiculous small amount of time, of course, to try to talk about labor history. In fact, it ended up being 7, and I'll say how that happened, but even so, same problem. And so the course had to be organized thematically, not simply chronologically, but thematically. And we did that by taking iconic kind of labor events from the past for at least the first 3 classes. So we went through, you mentioned the Seattle General Strike. We did the Bread and Roses strike before that. In the 30s, we looked at the longshore struggle in Portland, and we looked at a sit-in by the women who worked in retail in Woolworth in Detroit. And from that point on, but what we were doing in looking at the history really was looking at kind of strategic choices that are made. And that's part of what's unique about working with labor activists and how the course could be very different from what would happen with a different group, high school group or a college group. These were all people who had to face the same kinds of choices that they saw being made in the past. And so looking at the history really expanded their sense, or was designed to expand their sense, and I think it worked, of what the alternatives were.
So they immediately recognized those kinds of choices and tactic strategies that people then faced and chose, given the circumstances, and they saw themselves as facing similar sets of circumstances.
That was the idea. Immediately, I'm not entirely sure, because, of course, the range of possibilities was so much greater at different times and is now so much greater than people realize. There are many different kinds of labor organizations that can be built, and there are many different visions of what a union can be, beyond even the kinds of unions that we have. So the idea was, yes, you're right, they absolutely identified with the organizers of those different times and places, but as well expanded their sense of the potential by looking at the tough choices, the dilemmas that people had to make in the past. Dilemmas around who's organizable, who's important to organize, what kind of an organization are we building, and really toward what?
And there we can see perhaps greater differences between then and now, and maybe you could say something about the kinds of participants in this course. I mean, what kinds of unions and workplaces they come from and how that is different from some of those iconic events that you focused on, the Longshore Strike and the Bread and Roses Strike.
And different from even just a few years ago, you know, what I think of as our recent past. I did something similar in the early 80s here in town, brought people together from 17 different unions, rank and file activists, locally. They all were from manufacturing, and that was very, very interesting to see the way in which nobody from this course now, our course in 2017, came out of manufacturing. There were carpenters, there were people, there was SEIU, there were people engaged in the Burgerville organizing, people engaged in New Seasons organizing, teachers from the Nurse Association, from the electrical workers, etc., as well as a couple of people from union-related, from labor-related organizations, not unions, like Jobs with Justice itself or like Oregon Fair Trade. So these were all activists in labor, but a very different kind of cohort from what had been before.
Well, as Fran Michel mentioned in reading from the Jane McAlevey piece, Jane McAlevey points out that the new factory floors, the hospital and the school, that the nature of work has changed, and so the labor movement has got to catch up with this new kind of workforce and the possibilities that the female and people of color who dominate the memberships of these unions have to offer.
And perhaps we have to do more than just build the same kinds of unions, but with a different demographic. Maybe this raises the possibility of building even different kinds of unions, different kinds of workplace-oriented organizing efforts.
Okay, well, that was Jo Lee Carter, Please, Mr. Foreman. And Norm, as Mr. Carter sang, why don't you slow down your assembly line? Lord, you can look at me and see I don't mind working. Lord knows I do mind dying.
And you know, that's the title of a brilliant book in labor history about the League of Revolutionary Black Workers by Dan Georgiakis, Marv Serkin, Detroit, I Do Mind Dying. Great book in labor history, but about the African-American struggle within the automobile workers, the resistance to the kind of union that had been built just in the 20 previous years coming out of World War II.
And speaking of the United Auto Workers, the UAW, that was one of your class activities, was a simulation or a role play of the auto workers' shop floor and militant activists and how they participated in the new labor management regime that was trying to assert itself after World War II. Do you want to say something about why you selected that event or that scenario and what the participants in the workshop took away from it?
And why we did it as in the form of a role play also. Yeah, that it's a decisive time period, I believe. The kind of unions that we have now were shaped by the decisions made coming out of World War II. There were vast possibilities then. There had been a major worker organizing upsurge, of course, in the 30s. And during wartime, labor was in a very strong position. So coming out of World War II, there were a lot of choices to be made. Too many, I don't like teaching just by lecturing. I didn't have a good reading that would go over that range of possibilities the way I wanted. And so I thought a role play, but a role play also would take people inside the situation of having to make those choices themselves. And the choices are on the order of, well, we've been working till now using direct action. If something happens in the workplace and we don't like it, we directly confront the foreman, or we walk out, or we call a larger strike for the whole enterprise, you know, all the workers there. But what's replacing that now is a very formal, legalized system. You file grievances and they go through various levels and months later they may be dealt with, or maybe they're just a bargaining chip that the company, in the case of, say, one of the automobile companies, you get thousands of grievances accumulated and the union says, okay, well, will withdraw these grievances in exchange for some other concession. Very different system from the kind of direct action that workers were used to at that point. Or another very topical now kind of decision to be made coming out of World War II. What about healthcare? What about the welfare benefits? In Europe, those are all being pushed as countrywide. Everybody is entitled to health care. You get these systems in Scandinavia and Germany that are nationwide. So in this country, do we want to go for that? Or do we want to go through just the employer and win it just for our workers with the sense, you have to say, with the sense that we believe these will be spread to other employers, that the economy will grow, that eventually the unions making this decision thought that everyone still, we'd have national health care, it would just be done by a different vehicle.
And of course, in hindsight, of course, workers at the time didn't recognize just how quickly and effectively manufacturers and employers mobilized to resist these kinds of reforms that were taking place in other Western democracies.
Well, there are a few things to say about that. In the United States, we have the strongest ruling class in the world, also the most aggressive. And that reinforces your point. In Europe, the ruling class came out of World War II, both split and compromised by their various kinds of ambivalences around Nazism. The ruling class in the United States was absolutely triumphant. So that's one thing. Another is, I would not say that workers or the working class thought or misestimated. I think union leaderships in particular came out with kind of a myopic view that the upsurge, for instance, in auto sales, we're talking about UAW, would just continue, you know, from the 40s, early 50s, and already by the mid-50s, of course, you're starting to see the import of Japanese and German cars, and that upsurge doesn't just continue the way they had forecast. They based their strategy, and again, this is union leadership, because these decisions were very controversial within the union, they based their strategies on a misunderstanding of really of the nature of capitalism. They didn't anticipate the kinds of down cycles that would affect the organizing possibilities. They didn't anticipate the growth of competition through a globalized capitalism.
Norm, we should interject here that people are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Laurie Mercier talking with Norm Diamond about his recent Labor History for Labor Activists course sponsored by Jobs with Justice. So, Norm, in just some of the remaining time that we have, this seems like it was a wonderful course that should be continued. What a great organizing vehicle for many kinds of communities and grassroots groups in addition to labor. But what would you say you learned from this process, from these activist workers?
Well, there are a few things I want to say kind of in summary. It sounds like that's what we're leading to. One is, of course, that the course was filmed. We should say that. And it's in an editing process now. And the idea initially was to have it available for national distribution. And it will be. And it will be on local cable as well. So that's one thing maybe for people to keep in mind, that this will be available for viewing. Another thing is that the emphasis very much, we haven't said that so much in our talking now, was on strategic thinking. And that's something that I see an absence of in left activity, in our movement, and within labor. Actually thinking about what our objectives are that go beyond the simplistic and how to act in a way that enables us to accomplish them. So the entire focus was, we talked before about the different kinds of objectives, different kinds of organizations you might build, but really want to add toward what? What is it that we're after? And how do our efforts now relate to that toward what? For most of the people in the course, and this was a wonderful takeaway, a wonderful experience for me, it was a great group, a thoughtful group of people who are actively engaged as well. And so the thoughtfulness has a kind of feedback loop for them. They change their activity. They change the way they present themselves to other workers based on the thoughtfulness, based on what they were learning in the course too. And that in turn shapes the way that they I mean, their practice then in turn shapes the way that they think about things. And so seeing some of those changes in people, seeing some of the broadened sense of possibility for not only social possibilities, but for themselves and ways that they could reach out to others. Some of the people have been asked, some of the participants in the class have been asked by their unions to give workshops based on what they learned in this course. Others are incorporating some of what they learned into their own organizing efforts. I hear back from people, and of course, I have some invitations to come in and continue working with some of them. So all that's great fun.
So knowing something about the Seattle General Strike of 1919, 100 years ago, actually helps one in their strategic thinking?
Boy, you know, it shows the possibilities in Seattle and, of course, in Winnipeg just a few weeks later. Workers take over and run the town completely and do a whole lot better job of it than what had been happening before in the conventional administrations.
Well, I think that is part of the value of history, that it really opens up possibilities. It helps us imagine what could be, because certainly people of the past have imagined much greater things than we think that we're capable of.
We're living in a time of very narrowed possibilities in people's conception. You're right. It's important to open those up.